This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Lena van de Veneter is the author of Game Changers and joins us on the program this morning. Good morning, Lena.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Lena, firstly, how far back do we go with the advent of games for phones as far as apps that could be downloaded? What were the early ones?
The early ones, I'll sprick some Australian ones because I think that's important to do.
Yeah.
Some of the earlier ones were Flight Control. That was a game that a lot of people might remember, that you used your finger to drag a little plane into an airport, and then eventually more planes got to the airport. It got a bit more hectic. Helicopters were involved and they're a bit faster, and it all sort of got a bit more complicated that way. That was an Australian-made game. There was also Fruit Ninja. And this was back in sort of the Flight Control days of probably about 2008, so a while ago now. Fruit Ninja, another one that a lot of people might be familiar with because they it went completely gangbusters very early on. You use your finger to swipe across your phone screen or your iPad screen and you slice fruit.
And when you got really good at it, you'd use two fingers.
That's right. That's right. Or you'd do a zigzag pattern and really mix it up. So that was that sounds like not a really fun game to play, but it actually is because you've got a timer element, and then you've got to avoid the bombs and the hazards, and that can actually get quite fun. There's actually videos online of people's cats playing that game on their iPads, so it can appeal to more than just us.
Angry Birds would have been amongst those early. Is that early?
Yeah, it was fairly early. Rovio was seen as an overnight success by a lot of people with Angry Birds, but it was actually their 52nd title. So they've been doing things for quite some time. But yeah, Angry Birds was probably one of the largest ones that really captured the mainstream attention.
What is it that makes for a successful game? You said it before that, I mean, with Fruit Ninja, you swipe things and you cut them in half and you have to dodge bombs and so forth, and at the same time you have a time component. And there are level components as well. Is that what makes good games or games that attract us?
Well, there's lots of things that go into making a good game, and it's not necessarily fun. Sometimes it's that competitive element. Sometimes there's an engrossing story or something that really, you know, presents you with a moral dilemma that you find interesting. But I think with the mobile genre, the most popular use of mobile games is as pastime. It's just a submission towards the machine. You know, you've got 10 minutes waiting in the doctor's office, so you thought, I'll open up Scrabble or Words with Friends or that kind of thing, or Angry Birds or Flight Control or Pokemon Go, and just sort of see, you know, if I can just waste this 15 minutes and not be bored. I think that competitive element and that timed element really helps that, because you know you don't have to sink in 20 minutes for this beautiful narrative or even longer, as many other games, not on mobile phones, can be hours and hours and hours worth of investment. So I think when it comes to an attractive mobile game, something you can play between in the gaps in your life, I think that's probably going to be the most successful.
Lena, I'd love a conspiracy, and I wonder whether or not games are actually used for doing something else, whether or not they are finding information, whether or not they are tracking us, whether or not it's a way of delivering advertising.
Mm-hmm. Look, we need a conspiracy theorist in our community in some way. There always needs to be one. I think with Pokemon Go, that's especially becoming quite apparent that they want the data of the players. They want to know, you know, what you do with your phone and with your Google account, that kind of thing. They have updated it to fix that apparently, but that remains to be seen how effective that is over iPhone and Android. I think when a product is free, you are the product. Your data is the product. If you're getting something for free like Facebook or a mobile game or an app, then you have to think about why it's free. Either you're going to be advertised to, that's how they're going to make their money, or your data is going to be sold by them, and that's how they're going to make their money. I think you need to take it on as much as you're comfortable with basis and just move on from there. But there are things in certain game engines that track analytics. They track what time you opened up the game. They track how long it was until you quit the app. They track these sorts of things to then send back to the developer and tell them what your play experience was like so they can then improve it. So it's not all evil and it's not all marketing driven. Sometimes it's about improving the product.
Sounds evil to me. But the other thing that you'll find with games as well, I mean, you'll start out by downloading it and it's free. Then for you to be able to get further, you have to start spending money. And that can be a trap for a lot of young people especially.
It can, yes. And that's called in-app purchasing. And it's something you can turn off if you're worried about children having access to that. But it is disappointing to watch them realise that they can't... There's less around that you can't progress with, but you just have to progress much slower without them. But yeah, it's very disappointing to watch them realise that they can't play like they want to play. But, you know, sometimes you've just got to decide whether you're going to give that app money or not. And for a lot of people, I've noticed a free app, if they're really enjoying it and they're really getting a lot out of it, they'll do an in-app purchase just as a way to sort of tip their hat at the company, to sort of say thank you to the company, but they won't necessarily rely on them on an ongoing basis.
Some of them, though, within that, I mean, I can remember playing an Angry Birds game. I don't know, it must have been like the third or fourth or fifth or sixth instalment of it. And you couldn't get very far at all before you had to spend money. And it seems that one of the things that a lot of the games are doing is that they're making it less likely that you'll succeed unless you do spend money.
Yeah, and that comes down to that sort of race to the bottom that the app store's created in terms of finances for these companies. You know, the apps are either free or 99 cents, and games are very expensive to make. It's sort of been a wild west in a lot of ways, with people trying to decide how they're going to make this app make money for them, how they're going to cover their costs from development. And it takes a long time and a lot of money to make a game.
We've got lots of people on the phones wanting to join us. Hello, Anita.
Oh, good. Hello. I love hearing your voice every night.
Now, what did you want to talk about?
Well, I started out just kind of needing Facebook so I could communicate with family long distance, and I used a laptop. But it's morphed from, you know, an hour a day in the first game I play to, I guess, a lifestyle choice. And when I discovered the one that I played on the laptop could be played on the phone, I went, oh, when I go travelling, I can keep going, can't I? And then I just started with one game and added another one, and now I play while I listen to you every night.
Now, Anita, what sort of games do you play and why are they so infectious?
Well, there's several kinds, and I really enjoyed the comments of your guest there. Linear games, the ones that sort of progress from A to B to C, or level 1 to 10 to, you know, 100, and you see yourself getting somewhere. And I know I had one game that I was just obsessed, and I would buy credits or whatever to keep playing, but I've sworn off that now, and I play a cafe game, and I downloaded something called Talking Tom, and that's hilarious, and it's a way of making other people laugh when you show them what it's like.
Anita, so, do you think that some of these games are addictive?
Oh, definitely. If you've got an addictive personality, you're probably going to be enjoying using them. But at the same time, there are lots of people that are lonely out there that can't always do things for themselves physically, or they don't have people to talk to in their household. And having conversations or online interaction with other social players is like having an online family.
And is this like with Words with Friends?
I play role-playing games where there's a whole story behind it, like you just said.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I've got a whole guild family of 100 people worldwide that I play with every day.
Lena, is this... Thank you for the call, Anita, because it's an interesting point. Lena, is this one of the social aspects that there are within these games, especially when you play against people all around the world?
Definitely. It's definitely a draw card for a lot of people. And like Anita said, very much so the people that are disenfranchised or isolated from the world in a lot of ways. It can be their lifeline to actually making human contact with other people. Because it's not always as easy as, oh, just get outside and make friends. which is something that we hear a lot as gamers. Oh, you should go outside more. And then when Pokemon Go came out, everyone said, no, not like that. You're doing it wrong.
Go out in a different way. Things like words with friends, because I play that a bit. You look at that and you wonder whether or not there's almost a dating service incorporated within that. And that people talk to each other, people have photos of themselves. You wonder where, again, what the other, not necessarily an agenda, but the other ways that the games are used.
Well, it's sort of fascinating to watch that each game has its own little language and has its own shorthand a lot of the time. And I think when you get any two human beings together, there's a possibility for love there. So I think that's something that you can design with that in mind, perhaps try and encourage it, or you can try and dissuade it or manipulate that to your whims, I guess, and that's the beauty of being a designer.
Lena, one of the things I wondered with, now that we've got Pokemon Go, and we'll talk to some listeners about this as well in a second, is this the start of something? Because I was wondering if you can do that with Pokemon Go, does that mean that you can start doing first shooter games doing exactly the same thing? First-person shooter games?
You probably could. I don't know how it would go in an Australian app store. I think it would get taken down pretty quick smart if it did pop up.
Yep.
And I also think it's not in keeping with the majority of game players' morals and values. I think we would all kind of turn our nose up at that and say, oh, that's a bit too real. If it was presented like a laser tag kind of option, then maybe that might be acceptable, but I don't think any kind of gory real-world violence would be something that people would be craving en masse like Pokemon.
Because this is one of the things that I was wondering as well within this. Where, okay, so you've got a group of people who design games, all right, so they're sitting there and they come up with this Pokemon Go concept. And they go, okay, well, this is a great concept. It's going to do really, really well. Do we need to be careful because people might run off the road or walk in front of cars? Or do they sit down and take a look at the consequences of games?
They definitely do. It's part of the risk management of the design stage. So what they've done to sort of counteract that is the very first screen you see when you load up Pokemon Go once you've logged in and everything is be aware of your surroundings, be alert of your surroundings. They recommend that you don't play with headphones in and that you look around you while you're exploring for Pokemon. So I think it's something that they've definitely considered. And it's a lot like, remember the Nintendo Wii when that first came out? The game console you had to hold and it was wireless. But they encourage you to put the wrist strap over your hand because it's very easy to sort of swipe in a bowling ball movement and throw the remote across the room.
And everyone's TV's got broken.
That's right. So that's sort of something that risk management is something that designers definitely have to be aware of.
Spud, good morning.
Hey, Trevor, and your guest, how are you going?
Good.
Just going to prove that I'm in a truck.
Very good. I hope you're not in a town.
Yeah, well, I'm in the middle of the country, so I'm not in a town, so still be sleeping.
Fair enough.
There's four games that I play on my phone. There's Frog Race, there's Angry Birds, Truck Simulator. I don't drive the truck simulator as good as what I drive the real thing. But
so, anyway. Is there a truck driving game?
Yes, there's plane flying games.
There's
another
a goat
one I do.
Simulator as well.
A what? Sorry, Lena.
A goat simulator. There's everything out there.
What do you do? Drive the goat around?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Yeah, the one that I probably won't be doing is Pokemon Go. I mean, I chase enough animals out here without having to go and play it on a game.
Fair enough. Because what he's saying there, Lena, I mean, really there's a game out there that could interest most people, but we don't necessarily know that they exist. How do people who are marketing these games let people know that they exist?
It's a very, very difficult prospect, actually, because there's hundreds of apps going up every day, so it's really hard to just sort of keep up with it and to see the wheat from the chaff, I suppose. So marketers really have their work cut out for them to try and make you notice. If an app is featured by the App Store, it's pretty much guaranteed for success. So it's a really big deal for us developers if you can get your game noticed by the App Store and featured with pride of place on that sort of first screen. You are going to get hits and you are going to get downloads and you know, you might finally make enough money to break even.
Is most of it, so most of the people who do design games, make games, don't make money out of it, but if you do have a successful one, you'll make a killing.
Is that just what we think? It seems to be accurate in a lot of ways. I think in the case of something like Pokemon Go, that's pretty much guaranteed to do well anyway because it's got such a large following. You know, Nintendo has a large following, Niantic has a large following, Pokemon has a large following. So you put all these things together and it's going to explode. But I think we're seeing a lot of, especially in Australian game development, a lot of freelancers and a lot of people on really, really small teams now. Since the GFC, we lost all of our big studios and we lost our sort of international publisher presence. So we've got a lot of small teams working really hard to make games, and some of them take off, like Crossy Road was a really, multi-million dollar game made in Melbourne very recently. And that sort of shows that small teams with really good marketing strategies can actually pull something off. Whereas 10 years ago, we would have thought that was impossible. Well, 10 years ago, we couldn't understand the concept of an app store. So it's a wild west in a lot of ways.
Stewie, good morning.
Hey, g'day. Yeah, you going, Drew?
Good, Stewie.
I don't want to sound like a doom and gloomer, but there's a couple of things we missed. One with the open network games where you're on the internet, you also open up kids to predators or potential predators.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Secondly, Pokemon Go, it's called a disclaimer that goes at the front, which is just them covering their own ass, basically. So you can get the message at the front. It's up to you whether you believe it or not or take it in. I've seen three people almost get hit by a car in the last week because of Pokemon Go.
Yeah, Lena, Stewie, thank you for that. Because, Lena, that's what I was wondering, whether or not there is possibilities for litigation or if Pokemon deliberately put things perhaps in terms and conditions that's written somewhere in the middle of somewhere that means that they can't get sued.
I definitely think that warning at the front is part design risk management and part, minimising liability for sure. They're a huge company and it's going to be used by, 20 million people, which is the same as our population. So there's going to be bad things that happen for sure. We've got documented cases of lures being used. There's these things in the game called lures where you can designate a place in actual physical space that Pokemon are more attracted to, and then therefore people walk up to that place more to go catch Pokemon. And we've seen cases of people luring people to then rob them, and actually use it to take advantage of people and actually do criminal acts. So I think it's a really interesting question as to whether Pokemon is responsible for those criminal acts or not, or aiding them in some way. I wouldn't want to be the lawyer for the prosecution on that one, but I think it's definitely something people have to be aware of, especially when you're encouraging children to play this game, is to make sure you don't go anywhere you wouldn't normally go. Make sure you're alert of your surroundings and you're aware of where you are. Maybe travel in packs if you wish, which a lot of people do play Pokemon. You see them in groups. Don't do it on the move as much. If you're going to find a place that's a park, that's safe, that has no traffic, and probably go there. There's a lot of tips that can help make you safer.
Stewie's point about predators as well, and not necessarily with Pokemon, but for children who are playing games on phones, because a lot of kids have their own phones now or they're playing on their parents' phones. Is there a need for the people who are making games to recognise and be aware of that as well, especially when you're playing with people from other countries or from other places?
Yeah, I think there needs to be definitely an awareness on the developer's behalf of putting things in place to report accounts and to, giving the players an opportunity to say when someone is not in keeping with the values of the game or the community. Having said that, the parents responsibility is huge. I'm a parent too, and my children play games, and I wouldn't let them walk down the street by themselves, so I don't let them walk down the internet by themselves. That seems to be my general line in the sand that I work with. I think it's really dangerous to leave a child in a chat room by themselves, and we can't just rely on the developers to make that chat room safe. We have to monitor them too, and we have to make sure that we've got our eye on them at all times.
Is Lena, when you just say a chat room, because perhaps many people consider a chat room to be exactly that, just a chat room, do we have to now recognise that just because things are painted pink and there are cupcakes and there are clouds and rainbows, that doesn't necessarily make it safe?
Yes, I think we definitely need to be aware that a lot of games have a lobby in them or a chat room function in them. And if you're playing online with strangers, then you need to be really aware of that and careful with that.
And being careful with the information that you give out within that.
Exactly. And a lot of the cyber safety programs in our local primary schools are very good with that sort of thing, like making sure teaching them the THINK approach, which I can't remember the whole acronym at this hour, but it was something about never sharing your real name, just the basic cyber safety sort of stuff that we sort of learned as it was just becoming a thing in our lives.
I've got a text here saying, I play my games in the toilet. It's the only place I can get peace and quiet. And I got a message the other day from my wife saying, I know what you're doing in there. Says
that's fine. Just please clean it every now and then. Please clean the phone.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Lena. Good morning, Trevor.
Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
We have enjoyed your little chat here, especially the part about being in the toilet there. The games I like to play, I've got my phone in my hand, and we're looking at Texas Hold'em Poker 2, 3, Midnight Bowling 3, and Blockbuster 3. And those are the games I like to play on my phone.
So
like
mainly, you said, mainly gambling games, Tom?
Well, I'm bad at them, so I don't go out and gamble. So basically it's just my way of, like you said, wasting time in a doctor's office waiting for the call to come back. And so that's how I do it.
Tom, thank you. Lena, there are so many different gambling games out there, and there are problems associated with the gambling games of whether or not they then promote gambling in general, whether or not they're just fun. I mean, is that one of the things that the industry does look closely at?
They do, and it's seen as very, very bad etiquette to compare someone's game to gambling. The game developers would get very upset by that. But if their mechanics are that close, then maybe they need to have a red-hot look at themselves. A lot of the problems come down to the Minister for Gaming. Sounds like it should be helping us. Sounds like it should be something sort of similar to the Minister for the Arts, but it's actually gambling-related. So that doesn't help that we've already been associated with gaming in the public sphere, and on a governmental level, gaming is associated with gambling. That makes our job very hard when trying to find funds and trying to, legitimise ourselves as an industry and as makers and creators. There are lots of gambling games out there, and there is a crossover in the skill set. So I know a lot of people are very talented games programmers or games artists, and then they get hired by a pokies company or an online gambling company because they have the skill set to cross over, and there's not as many jobs as there used to be. So I can sympathise and empathise with developers that find themselves making these games sometimes, because there's not a lot out there all the time. And it's sometimes you can gamble for free on these sorts of games. Like, so you can say that Texas Hold'em's gambling, but unless Tom is actually, using his own money and spending real money, then I don't really see the harm as much. It's a nice little place to train and to learn how to play poker. And as long as you're not doing anything you're uncomfortable with, and just tread lightly and always make sure that you've got, a gambler's help number next to you if you're worried about it becoming a controlling force in your life, then I think you can be okay and you can navigate those spaces safely.
The other thing along with that, again, it's children. If there are children that are picking up these games and playing that and then it leads to gambling, that's another issue within itself. But you could say that there are a lot of games where you have to buy things to be able to increase levels, and there are a whole stack of bells and whistles and colours and things that attract you to that, to having to spend money. It's almost a form of gambling within itself.
It can, it could definitely be seen that way. I can see how it would definitely look that way to a lot of people who are especially looking at it with fresh eyes. I think that they bring a really interesting perspective that we need to be aware of.
A text here saying, "Hi Trev, I'm in my 80s. An 80s generations gamer, and I still prefer console games over mobile phone games. I prefer the couch and the controller over Angry Birds," says Adrian. Another text saying, "I'm an older person and enjoy playing mind games, where you find things, or Mahjong, or things where you play against the clock. These games keep my mind working, and they're good for high hand-eye coordination," says Nana in Mount Barker. And that is quite a good point, because one of the things that's being put across now is it's important to keep your mind active, especially when you're older. Is there a feeling amongst people that are making games that that's something that they can be doing, especially for older people?
Oh, definitely. There's Nintendo did a big brain training sort of push on the DS when that first came out, the Nintendo DS, and that was all about, you know, these brain teaser games and games to get your grey meats working, as they said. It's definitely, and there's also a genre called serious games, which are games that are not played for fun or not developed for fun. They've developed for a specific purpose. So we're seeing a lot of games being made in that sort of headspace for health and for rehab.
Can you give us an example?
There was one. The first thing that comes to mind is actually a simulation that the FBI used, but that's not for health. That's for training their armed services. Very, very opposite to health, actually. There was a game, and I can't remember for the life of me the name of it, because it is quite it's used in the medical field, so it's not publicly available. But it was something like Resus. It was a training thing for medical professionals, and it had Resus in the name, and it was teaching people how to do CPR. And that was a really easy way that they could tell, you know, the medical students to get the app, and then the app would help train them. And it was set up like a game. It used gamification mechanics to motivate the person to learn more. And we're seeing that in rehab as well, that a lot of iPad games in particular are being used to sort of put, you know, matching games and things are good for putting two and two together. So they sort of say those two things are similar. And these, you know, for people who are recovering from all sorts of injuries, they can be ways to sort of reopen pathways in the brain. But a lot of them, it's hard to sort of name specific ones, because a lot of them are proprietary medical sort of tools.
Quite simply, though, but even games like Words with Friends or 2048 or Mahjong that you can play, or a lot of the word games, or what's that horrible thing where you add up numbers? Sudoku?
Oh, Sudoku, Sudoku?
For the life of me, can't work out how to do that. But they're games that people can play that keep your mind active.
That's right, and it's sort of sitting in the same place in our lives as the crossword would, or, you know, the Sudoku on the newspaper. There's definitely those apps out there, and a lot of them are free most of the time, or at very low cost if you'd like to kick a couple of dollars to the developer. It's exciting, and it's cool to think about that we're educating our brains and exercising our brains when we could just be staring at a wall in the doctor's office.
I'll go back to calls in just 1 second. You just said something about buying games to make sure you're kicking money into the developer. If you buy the game, then you can generally not have to cop the barrage of advertising that you get.
That's right.
Is it better for us for the developers, obviously, to buy the game because they don't get any of that advertising revenue?
Well, it depends. It depends on how much they're getting out of the advertising revenue, which is always really hard to gauge. Sometimes it's a lot, sometimes it's barely anything. But specifically with Australian developers, I would highly recommend that if you're really enjoying yourself and you got it for nothing, just kick them a couple of dollars with an in-app purchase or for the pro version if you want to get rid of ads. Or sometimes they have a pro version that has nothing to do with advertising. So if that's the case, then, just sort of try and make sure that they're being rewarded for the joy that they've given you.
Okay, so why though, Lena? Is it because developers aren't making very much money? It's because their expertise or their artistic expertise isn't being rewarded?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. It's also a really tough industry to work in, especially for women. If you know that the game was developed by a woman, then give her a pat on the back because she's been through a bit of stuff. it's a tricky industry to work in. The bottom has fallen out of our industry since 2008, since the GFC, where we went from having about 2,000 jobs all over Australia to about now we have something like 500. At the census. And we've also got about 4,000 games graduates coming out of games degrees every year. It's becoming a harder and harder place to work. There's more people coming in, but less jobs. It's very cutthroat, very difficult to succeed.
Lena, is it like we understand now why it's important not to pirate films or not to pirate television programs? Is it the same sort of thing for developers of games, in that if you're getting it for free, recognise that there are people who are working within that industry and that we shouldn't necessarily think of ourselves just getting it for free?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels there between piracy and patting people on the back for the work they gave you and the games industry for sure.
Jody, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Jody.
That's good. I've got two games I really love playing on my phone, and that's Four Picks One Word and Bejeweled Blitz.
Now, Bejeweled is huge. I don't quite get Bejeweled.
Oh, I love Bejeweled because I'm good at it. So, yeah, kids always get cranky with me. Mum, how can you get 3 million top scores? Because I'm good. Yeah, so that's my one for the kids because I always, I try and go out and play their games with guns and all that and I'm hopeless. But, yeah, get me on my Bejeweled and I'm just, they can't catch me. So,
Jody, how did you find out about it?
By a friend. We was actually out one night, having a few lagers, and one of the girls said, "Yeah, try this Bejeweled Blitz," because I was never one for playing games on your mobile. I said, "Oh, well, I'll give it a go," and well, I've been addicted ever since. And it's every fortnight I allow my $60 go and buy them credits so I can play my Bejeweled, So it's a bit of an addiction, that one, for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a worry. Well, it's a sort of a worry in itself, but I want to talk to Lena about that. Lena, is one of the best bits of marketing for gaming is basically word of mouth?
I think so, definitely. I think if it's got that social link to it, you're more likely to play it. So that's why we're seeing Pokemon taking off, because people are playing it in groups. You have to pledge allegiance to a team. You have to then try and get your team to take over the local Pokemon gym. My local Pokemon gym is actually Sydney Myers Grave because I live near a cemetery.
Oh, okay.
And it's very interesting where some of those gyms are. I think that social aspect is what really pulls people into it. And when you've got a friend who's also playing the game and you can talk to them about it and say, well, what level are you up to? Or, oh, I just got this cool new item to help me do this faster. Then you've got a dialogue going and you're more likely to play it. You're more likely to download it and buy it than you otherwise would be.
Lena, more than that, though, in that most of the games that I've ever played have been told to me from other people. They've said, oh, you should try this game, or I play this one and it's really good. And generally younger people who are telling you about things that they did 5 years ago, and us that are older, we're just sort of picking up on it now.
Yep. Yeah, it's because there are so many games out there, I think, as well, that we use our friends as sort of the arbiters of worthy games, the people who can say, no, this one's actually good. I can vouch for this one because there is just so much out there and there's so much junk out there too. There's so many really terrible games on the App Store and on the Android App Store, and there's a lot of vitriol to move out of the way. So I think when a friend can vouch for something, you're more likely to act on that.
Riley, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, TC and Lena. Lena, you've made a mention in regard to the GFC and the reduction of jobs in the gaming or in the games industry, loss of studios. Can you be a little bit more detailed on that?
Yeah, sure. So we had about 50 large studios, and when I say large studios, it means employing about 100 people, doing work for hire contracts, but also working on quite large projects. And when the GFC came along and the Australian dollar sort of changed so dramatically compared to the US, we had a lot of American publishers here. We had at least a presence of them being here, and we sold our games to them. When they couldn't get cheap labor anymore, and it became less attractive to have a game made in Australia for them, they all sort of left, and our studios closed pretty quickly over approximately 6 years. They pretty much all just stopped. You would see them pare down and then eventually close entirely. And that was very different to, say, 2007. It wasn't uncommon for game studios to take entire graduating levels from private colleges who were teaching game design degrees. They would just take everyone who graduated and hire them. So that's a very, very, very different world to what it is now.
Is it coming back? Is the industry on the way up again?
I think it is, but in a very different shape and in actually a more exciting way. I think what we're seeing now is a lot of smaller teams, but we're seeing people still craving working together with a lot of people. So we're seeing these co-working spaces popping up, and that seems to be the spaces that studios are occupying now. And people don't want to call themselves a studio anymore. They call themselves, you know, a collective or a collaboration, which I find really interesting that they want to differentiate themselves from the way it used to be. And they're sort of collectivizing together and helping each other out, whereas the studio system used to see people having their cards very close to their chest. If a developer from another studio was visiting, they were followed around to make sure they didn't snoop, and so were journalists and that kind of thing. Whereas now, you know, it's not uncommon to see in a co-working space here in Melbourne in the arcade or down in Renew Docklands, they just wander into another office and say, hey, does anyone know how to get you know, this software development kit working? Because I can't figure it out for the life of me. And then there's a real camaraderie and...
Lena, and hopefully the industry will continue to rise. We'll talk to you again because we've only just touched the surface on gaming. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.